This is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. And once again, we return to Bombay and producer Julian Crandall Hollick's impressions of the city's poorest people who live on the pavements of Apna Street. Bombay is a magnet for all sorts of people, from those trying to make a fortune to others just trying to get through the day. According to Julian, there are people there who beg for a living, but most manage to survive without asking others for money. One question kept nagging at him. Why must so many newcomers, even those with jobs, make their first homes on the streets? Is it bad city planning, callous indifference, or both? He searches for answers in this installment, which he calls We the Invisible.
One evening, not so long ago, I had dinner with Bhaktava Shroff. Bhaktava is happily married and a mother, and she works as a finance officer for a major airline. I told her a bit about the life of the pavement dwellers in Baikala. Bhaktava said I should come round the following week. Then I'll tell you what I think of them.
Do you feel that these pavement dwellers should be allowed to live on the streets of what were once beautiful?
So here I am,
residential,
and here is Bhaktava.
I feel that, firstly, the migration into the city should be stopped. They should be gainfully employed in their native places, in their villages, so that they don't get encouraged to come to Bombay City and live on the pavements.
Just because you're well-educated and kind doesn't mean you can't have some real blind spots. And this isn't just Bhaktava being Bhaktava trying to shock me. Bhaktava's saying what most people in this city rarely think under their breaths. Send them back home.
The second thing is that they live in such a society that even if you do house them, they'll sell their houses tomorrow and find another slum for themselves. It's the lifestyle, it's the lack of education that has created this. And this is something that cannot change unless the government makes education compulsory for the future generation. And only then will they start to understand the importance of a better standard of living.
I really don't think going to school's got much to do with this. The equation education equals better standard of living equals living in a pukka, a proper house. It looks good, it sounds good on paper, in textbooks and policy papers, but in the real world it's a different story. In India and elsewhere, you can work hard and still not be able to afford something as basic as a proper house and all that goes with it. But the well-off are usually completely unaware of what poor people think and want and how they live their lives. The upper classes, to call them by their proper name, live in a world where too many things can be taken for granted and are. Otherwise, how could Bhaktava make statements like this one?
According to them, they have a wonderful standard of living. They have no overheads, no housing costs, no lighting costs, no gas costs. They're living from day to day. They beg or they work. They earn their money, they eat their food, and they go to sleep. Why would they live in a flat where there would be outgoings of 200-300 rupees a month? That's become their life, and hence they will not change it.
Should those huts be demolished and the streets cleared?
The streets should be cleared, the huts should be demolished, but they should be housed properly, either in their native places and given gainful employment, or taken nearby to a factory, given small accommodation and made to work in a factory outside the city limits.
Bhaktava would probably make a good politician. She has great sound bites. But I honestly believe her opinions on pavement dwellers are totally divorced from reality. Now, literally a stone's throw from Bhaktava lives Sheila Patel, who spent half her life working with the pavement dwellers here on the streets in Baikala. Same social class, same education as Bhaktava, but a very different sensibility and very different sound bites.
If you talk to anybody in the city of Bombay, they're always talking about those poor people. They talk about themselves as we, that's the educated people, and they say that Bombay belongs to us. Everybody else is they. But it's the they that make the city work. All those who live on the pavement are the most they of them all. They don't show up in any statistics. The city planners always deny their existence, and they deny their contribution to the city's economy. It is as if they were invisible.
This is more than just a class thing, or an advanced case of cultural myopia. Underneath is something you find in the first world, the second world, the third world, the fourth world, all the worlds. The failure to understand today's relationship between city and countryside.
If you go and talk to any of our policy makers, they still live in this mythical dream world in which they have these wonderful images that all poor people need to go back to villages. And that, to them, is the solution.
So national governments, international lending institutions, private development organizations, they've all been pouring oceans of money into rural development schemes to keep people on the land and out of the cities. It's a great and generous idea, but it may be money poured into the past, when what's needed today are jobs and infrastructure for where the action really is, in the towns and cities of countries like India. If I'm a businessman in India, for example, I'm not going to invest my new factory out in the middle of nowhere. I'll want to place it near my markets or near a good rail, air or seaport, in Bangalore or Madras or Ahmedabad or Bombay, where you've got everything. Telephones that work, good links to the rest of the country and overseas, good schools, good hospitals, lots of banks, lots of head offices. In other words, lots of reasons to invest.
We've been saying for the last 10 years that if you allow and encourage so much investment in this city, Bombay I mean, then it's also going to attract people. And so the city shouldn't look so surprised when there are so many migrants who come in. If you have a region which is drought-prone or which has no industry, why should you be shocked when people come from there to large cities? But they do feel shocked. They look shocked and they behave accordingly.
From the 10th floor of the elite Jaslok Hospital, you get a very special view of the city. You also get a rather different perspective on the problem of the pavement dwellers.
Are you an economist, sir? And have you read D'Souza? Hello? Yes, why not? Yeah.
If there's one person in this city who ought to know at least some of the answers, it's this man, J.B. D'Souza, former Bombay Municipal Commissioner, the city manager, in other words. That was back in the late 60s and early 70s, when the city pulled itself away from its colonial roots and became a modern metropolis, and when the Ramats and Saminas of Baikala first came to Bombay. J.B.'s always been a bureaucrat, but now he basks in the benefits of hindsight.
Very true. This is absolutely correct. Somehow, the government and all other semi-government bodies have never looked kindly on these people, because the governments are run by elitist class politicians and bureaucrats, people like me. They regard these people as interlopers, invaders, whatever. And from time to time, attempts are made to clean them out and throw them out, which means they're thrown out from one place and they go to another. That's all that happens.
D'Souza admits that city planners in his day, if they thought of workers' housing at all, they thought of it in terms of unionized industries like the cotton mills. They completely ignored small business. But planners all over the world made much the same mistake.
The small industry, the repair shops, these are vital parts of Bombay's economy. Take them away and Bombay's industry, organized industry, may come to a standstill, because there is so much that organized industry farms out to these small people.
Shopkeepers, small businesses, repair shops, these people are always looking for cheap labor. That's why people migrate from their villages to come here to Bombay. But once they're in the city, they're caught in a classic catch-22. They're working, but they don't earn enough to afford decent housing. 4 million of them end up in slums. Almost 500,000 can't find even that. So they end up in a place of their own, but on the pavement. In an ideal world, J.B. D'Souza would love to build permanent housing for the pavement dwellers on the 13 acres of the Katow Mill site in Baikala, if and when the mill ups and leaves. But in practice, even the best of intentions fly straight out of the window.
It would still be misallocation of resources, would it not? Because that's very valuable land. Even if the mills go away, it's very valuable land. Now, should it not go to the highest bidder?
Now the city wants builders in the heart of Bombay Island to include some low-income housing in their new developments. But that won't really solve the problem. The poor will move in all right, but a few weeks later, somebody will come along and offer them more money than they can ever hope to earn in their lifetimes if they'll just sell up and move back to the pavements or to the slums further north. As long as market forces determine land use, the poor will probably always get shafted. It was a February afternoon when Sheila Patel dragged me along to the Sea Green Hotel to meet these architecture students from London. They'd come to make a study of Bombay's planning, or lack thereof. They were still at that stage of innocence when it's assumed there must be a rational, considered, and fair solution to any problem.
Saying that their issue was housing.
Is there a plan for the city's future development?
Most of us,
yes, there was and is, answered Sheila. And I first saw it back in 1984.
So we were very naive and we said, well, maybe we can find place for poor people to stay. So how do you find that? We say, okay, there must be some land allocated for poor people's housing. I mean, you can't have a government and a city corporation which doesn't plan for poor people's housing. So we went and we got these silly development plans. And we took these women who are with us in the form of women's collectives to locate every single place which was marked as housing for the poor on those plans.
It was an eye-opener. As they compared what was marked on the map with what was actually there on the ground, Sheila and the women made some surprising discoveries.
And you'll find that whatever is the green belt is in fact the industrial belt. And whatever is meant for housing the poor is in fact being reconstructed as upper income housing. So you see all these things.
The culprit, of course, is money, legal and illegal, that's changed hands and made a mockery of the famous plan.
On those plans. And we saw warehouses and go downs and factories and all kinds of things in all those places. So then, in the same naivety, we went to the chief secretary, who was then reviewing these plans for the Bombay Municipal Corporation. And we said, why is this happening like that? So he told me, this is a notional plan. This is how we'd like it to be. And that's really, in a sense, what it is. Yes, it's a dream plan.
Back here in Baikala, these plans seem to come from a different world, figments of a planner's imagination, light years away from the reality of how thousands of people live here on the pavements. And in the end, we always seem to come back to the same two basic hang-ups. First, that pavement dwellers are parasites. The plain truth of the matter is they're not, but nobody really seems to be able to see them for what they are and do. They're all but invisible, even though they're a vital part of the city economy. Businesses and the upper classes want their labour, but they want it as cheap as possible, even if that means forcing them to live near their employment and on the pavement. The second hang-up is that cities are just crumbling nightmares, urban cancers entering into their final death agony, and whose terrible growth must be contained, even reversed, at all costs.
The reality today is that cities are where the growth is. That's where the jobs are, and that's why people come here. It's better to recognize this fact and plan accordingly. And cities aren't a dirty word. Cities exist and flourish precisely because of what they are and what they can offer. We need to realize that reality and stop shutting our eyes to this.
I'm Julian Crandall-Hollick in Bombay.
Next week, Julian joins Sakina in her hut for lunch and makes a surprising discovery in the segment he calls Water Street, USA. We received a piece of electronic mail this past week about our series from John Burbridge in Seattle. He wrote, "Julian Crandall-Hollick's masterful vignette of life on Apna Street in the Baikala neighborhood of Bombay rekindled precious memories for me. For 4 years during the early 1980s, I lived just around the corner from the Baikala fire station described by Hollick. No matter what time, day or night, when I went out or returned home, I would be greeted by a chorus of people, from Tony, the toothless fruit walla, to Charlie, the one-armed leper, a permanent fixture at our front gate. One person remains with me above all the rest. She is the wrinkled-faced woman with a stooped back and a ragged sari, who would collect our heavily laden garbage cans and carry them down 4 flights of stairs to have first pickings. More than any government-generated campaign, she taught me to recycle and reuse. The real lesson was when several days after throwing out used notepaper, it would come back to me as a wrapper for the 100 grams of peanuts I bought at the corner store. Thanks for the memory." We are interested in your comments about the Apna Street series. You can send them to us at Weekend Edition Sunday, 635 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. Our email address is wesun@npr.org. And you can call our listener line. That number is 202-371-1775. Major funding for Apna Street comes from the Ford Foundation and the Biden-Pell Development Education Fund.